Up next, whether you attach your deck to the house or keep it freestanding, and a discussion about moles and voles on the Handy Guys Podcast.
Welcome to the Handy Guys Podcast, a podcast for handy guys from handy guys. Here are the handy guys themselves, Brian and Paul.
So, Brian, you are continuing in your deck project, and there is one item.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, there's one item that's kind of unique, and that is that you're looking to build a freestanding deck, even though it's right next to your house. And that is kind of unique. Usually they're attached to the house to a ledger board.
Yes.
And there are some potential problems. There's pros and cons of doing it that way. So we're going to talk a little bit on this podcast about why you might want to do a freestanding deck versus one attached to the house. And also we're going to talk about moles and voles. What are they? Where they come from? And how you kill them. What you do with them. So why don't you provide our contact information?
Okay. Just go to our website, www.handyguyspodcast.com. Click on the contact tab, and our information is there to reach out to the Handy Guys. You can also Twitter us. We are at Handy Guys on Twitter. Or you can Facebook us. We are facebook.com/thehandyguys, and you can contact us that way if you like.
Got a project on your honey-do list? Let the Handy Guys know about it, and they may talk about it on their next podcast.
So, Brian, I am no expert on any animal in the animal kingdom, but especially not moles or voles. Okay. So I am just living my life like every regular handy guy, happy that it's wintertime and I'm not doing any backbreaking yard work or anything like that. And yet I come out of my house and I think it was in January or December, and I noticed these holes are forming around the sidewalk of my front walk that walks up from the driveway to the front porch. And I see these various holes. And at first, I'm thinking, oh, man, what is this? I bet you it's a mole, because I've noticed that there, in previous years, I would occasionally see some tunnels in my garden. And we talked about that, I believe, on another show, that you know the best way to get rid of moles is to take away their food source, which is typically grubs. Okay?
Yes.
And
yes.
You can apply Grub X or something like that. And I think I've done this in previous years, and those tunnels seem to have gone away, or at least they stayed in my garden and they never bothered my lawn. So I could live with that, you know, no big deal. Just a little bit of mulch lifted up from here and there in these little tunnels.
Okay.
Well, this is different. I started to get these holes that were pretty significant next to the sidewalk, and dirt lifted up. And we had a lot of snow this winter, so typically I couldn't see my lawn, but I could just see some of the areas where it melted around the sidewalk, and we'd have some light snows, and I'd see these holes forming. And then suddenly, one day, I go out front, and it was right after us. We had a little bit warmer weather, and the snow that was in the yard had melted, and I noticed that there were tunnels all over my front lawn.
Oh, no.
Not just in the garden. And these weren't just tunnels. So previous to that, I had tunnels, what looked like tunnels, in the garden, and I bought a vole trap. And a vole trap is something you can set that has these little jagged kind of spikes, and you put this thing on the ground, and the idea is there's one spike that pierces the ground and goes right through the tunnel, and the idea is that when a mole, let me see if I can remember this. No, I take that back. The spikes are above the ground, but what you do is you press this trap down on a tunnel. And so the idea is that you cave in the top of the tunnel so that when a mole comes through the tunnel, it gets upset that its tunnel is caved in and tries to, you know, press it open and rebuild it. And it pushes up on this trap, essentially triggering the trap so that the spikes come down into the tunnel and either pierce the mole or trap it. So that's how a mole trap works. And I got a couple of them really cheap at the local big box center, local home center. They were on sale for like $3.99 a piece. So I bought a couple of them. They didn't catch anything. Part of it was because the ground was too hard and it was wintertime. But when the snow melted, I started to see something different from tunnels, and that was on the surface of the grass, it was as if someone took a trimmer, like a string trimmer, and just started going to town, running the thing vertically and making these narrow little trails all over. So I had sort of a cacophony. That's a large word. I can't say.
Cacophony?
I was trying to say that, but I couldn't say it. I had sort of a maze of trails, maybe about a 10 by 10 square foot area, 100 square foot area, of just a maze of these little trails all over the place. And it was on the surface, not underneath.
Weird.
Yeah. So I thought, this is great. At first, I wasn't too worried because it was just in my garden. And then it was all over my yard. And I thought, I needed to do something about this because not only were the holes themselves that were next to the sidewalk getting larger, but then you have these trails all over. So I did a little bit of research. I looked up some pictures, and literally my picture of my front lawn could have been posted on all these sites that describe not a mole, but a vole. It was textbook encyclopedia.
And those are the ugly looking ones. They don't look like a mouse. They got like a funny shaped...
Just the opposite. The moles, moles are the ugly looking things. The voles are essentially like a mouse.
Okay.
A fancy name for a mouse that lives both underground, but they also come on the surface. And from some research, they seem to like underneath snow for some reason.
Okay.
I guess it's quasi, you know, underground, above ground.
Well, Paul, let me tell you a little story about my moles or voles that I have. I noticed next to the concrete for the Bilco door that goes into my basement some holes, and my dog noticed the same holes. And so those little holes turned into big holes because the dog kept digging, trying to get at whatever was causing them.
Right.
And I have a few spots in my yard where I have like tunnels, but they're like right under the thatch of the grass.
Right.
So they're not, it doesn't look like a slit cut in the grass like you described, but there are sort of areas where, you know, you walk and, oh, there's nothing there anymore. Like they've eaten all the bottom of the grass.
That's a, I think that is a vole. They eat like the grass and you have these little areas.
They eat like the roots of it or something.
Yeah. The voles though... The voles really go for don't go for the grass. Excuse me, the moles. The moles go for what we talked about, grubs. The voles will eat roots, especially things like if you have like tulip bulbs or things like that or other plants. They go for those plants and they'll go for the grass. So it sounds like you do have voles.
Okay. So how do I get rid of them?
Well, there's.
I think the dog might have gotten a couple.
Yeah, the dog may have handled them. In my case, and there's a few methods, and they're really not that difficult. You can put poison down in the holes and hope that they eat that. But sometimes they just don't go for the poison. You can, and again, they're kind of like they're essentially just mice. I decided to go old school and just use an old fashioned mouse trap, snap trap, and see what would happen. And it took me about a week. I'd put it out there, and sometimes it was triggered. But I didn't know if it was just because of the bad weather and all the snow and everything. And sometimes it would stay out there a couple of days and it would start getting rusty and wouldn't do much. So supposedly they like apples. And so you can put pieces of apple on the trap. Or in my case, I just went with my old standby, which is peanut butter. Put that on the trap. I put it right near one of the holes. And after at least a week or so of trying, and it was kind of a pain because in the problem with traps dealing with voles or that, you know, you're sitting these out in your lawn. So you have kids walking through and you might have some toddler stepping on this thing. So I had to kind of like remember to bring it in, put it back out. In one case, I think one of the kids did trigger it, but they didn't get hurt or anything. So, it was funny. It was a day where we were expected to get a lot of snow and early in the morning, we got just like 3 or 4 inches. And then later in the day we got a foot, but in that early morning snow, I look out the window and everything is white. We have about 3 or 4 inches of snow. But I look out and on top of everything white, I see this black thing moving around. And I say to my kids, I said, I think we trapped something. So we look out there and I get out closer and sure enough, I've trapped something that is, I would say, It looks like a mouse, like we said, but it's more the size, in this case, of a gerbil, kind of fat.
Oh, it's bigger than a mouse.
Yeah, yeah. It was a good size, and so I had to take care of it. I put it out of its misery. But and the odd thing, Brian, is all this damage seems to have been caused by just one, because I've had the trap out. I put it out again for a few days to see if I would trap any more. Nothing, and I've seen no more damage.
Hmm.
So it seemed like only one vole did all this. And since then, I've been at a couple of relatives' homes and seen that they've had the same kind of damage. And in their case, they live in a development that's taken care of for them, a condominium-type facility. And the maintenance people put out some poison and said that this will actually just make them thirsty, and they'll leave the area and go towards the creek. There was a nearby creek, and they'll be gone. But anyway, that's how it's typically handled. I didn't want to either deal with the poison or the neighbors, you know, accidentally poisoning the neighbor's cat or something like that. So I just went
with
the trap.
That's what I worry about with poison and having a dog, because
exactly.
You know, my dog caught a vole. You know, the dog would probably consume the vole,
right.
And if the vole had consumed the poison, right. Then the dog's in the poison.
Exactly.
So,
but it really was not. In many ways, it was a lot easier, I think, than a mole. But boy, did it do some serious damage in a rather just short period of time, only a couple weeks. So there you have it. That's what you do if you got voles.
All right.
Up next, we're going to talk some more about your deck and why you chose a freestanding deck.
All right.
Don't know where to get reliable answers for your do-it-yourself projects? Why not search the Handy Guys Archive at handyguyspodcast.com?
So, Brian, what exactly is a freestanding deck, other than a deck, I suppose, out in the middle of your yard? But in this case, it's a deck that is up against your house, but what makes it a freestanding, or why did you choose a freestanding?
Sure. Well, when you look at accidents with decks that collapse,
mm-hmm.
most often it's because of a failed connection between the house and the deck. That's the most common reason the decks fail. And by building a deck freestanding, you eliminate the possibility of that connection between the house and the deck failing.
Sure.
And that's one of the reasons why freestanding is a good way to go. Also, you don't need to worry about water infiltration, because when you build a deck that's not freestanding, it's attached to the house. You have something called a ledger board that's attached to the rim joist of the house. And then there's a flashing detail that needs to be done exactly correct, or you're going to get water into the house.
Right.
Or you may not have anything to attach to on your house. So you might have stucco, you might have a faux masonry type siding,
mm-hmm.
brick veneer, stone veneer. Your floor structure in your house might be built with these newer I-joists, something like that. And if you attach to a rim joist, you're relying on the connection from that rim joist to your floor joist system to be solid. And sometimes you don't know how well that connection was made. And if you have a finished basement with drywall on the ceiling, you don't have access to inspect that connection either, or to reinforce that connection.
Right.
Another reason is if you have like a chimney or some other cantilevered section of your house that comes out beyond the typical foundation.
Right, it could be a bump out window or door as well.
Right. You can't attach to that because there's nothing supporting that underneath. And all you're relying on, if you attach to that, would be the couple of nails that are holding that rim joist on.
Right, so they don't always truly cantilever that. They just tack on some joist.
Yeah, they might tack it on, or even if it is cantilevered, you still have just that rim joist that maybe has a couple of nails holding it.
Right.
And that's it.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So
yeah.
you So you can't rely on just those few nails to hold up the entire side of a deck.
Gotcha, yeah. So normally the rim joist is sitting on, it's one, a longer piece, and it's sitting on top of the foundation.
Right on
the
foundation.
So it's supported, yeah.
Right. So in my case, I have a bump out for the slider door. I also have a bump out where a bay window is. So my deck along the house is 26 and a half feet, and I only actually had 7 feet of rim joist that was not cantilevered over the house, over that 26 feet.
Mm-hmm.
So we designed it as freestanding, and essentially all that means is you're going to put in another beam right next to the house that your joists are then going to sit on that beam instead of sitting on or attached to a rim or a ledger board that's attached to your rim joist. So you're going to do that when, one, you don't have a solid method of attachment to the house because of either how the house was built or because of the cantilevers. You're going to do it a freestanding deck because you don't want to deal with the potential failed flashing detail or potential water infiltration. And you're going to do it because you want a more solid connection.
So why wouldn't, if it,
a more solid construction?
More solid construction, but why wouldn't, if there's so many benefits to doing it, why is almost every deck connected to the rim joist and not freestanding?
It's easier and it's cheaper.
Okay. And are there other advantages? Like, wouldn't it be more stable if the deck was attached to the house as opposed to freestanding?
Yeah, that's a consideration. It's potentially more stable laterally. In other words, your deck could potentially move because there's nothing big like a house holding one side of it up.
Yeah.
So what you have to do to compensate for that is you have to put in cross bracing between your posts and your joists to prevent any movement side to side, forward or back, left and right. So there's more structure underneath. You've got another beam. You've got cross bracing. And so that adds to the time. It adds to the cost. It adds to the complexity a little bit.
So, and when you add that extra beam, then like you have more posts. And so therefore you have more footers. And, you know, you get more concrete that you're pouring. And if you're in the north, you got a lot more digging, and so that's where you get your additional labor and costs.
Exactly. So, in my case, it was 4 extra footers, 4 extra posts, 4 extra sonotubes for the concrete, an extra beam, and then all of the cross bracing required to make that stable. So, yes, it adds to the cost. I would say it does not add to the complexity because properly flashing a ledger board is complex. You have to remove the siding of the house, which is your, you know, whether it be vinyl siding, wood siding, brick, stucco, whatever your kind of siding you have. And that's your water barrier. That's the raincoat that your house has. So you have to cut a big hole in that. And then you need to properly reseal that so that it doesn't let water into the house and so that it can dry out as well. So your structure can stay dry. And so there's systems out there that space that ledger board away from the house so that air can get behind there and circulate to keep that rim or that ledger board dry, things like that. But instead of exploring all of those possibilities, I just kept it, my deck about, the finished deck's going to be about 1/2 inch, 3/4 inch away from the house. And the raincoat, if you will, the siding is intact completely and not penetrated whatsoever.
So you said in last week's podcast that your decking material, which is Ipe, can last 50 to 100 years. If in, say, 20 years, when you need to replace your siding, you'll be able to get to it and replace it without interfering with the deck?
That would be a difficult proposition.
Nothing's easy, is it?
Nothing's ever easy, no. So how would I do that? Yeah, Nate, I don't know how I would do that, Paul. It would be a challenge. My rim joists, you still have a rim joist of your deck. It goes around the perimeter, and it holds all your joists perpendicular. Even when you go freestanding, there's a rim joist near the house. And in my case, it's about an inch and a half away. And so you'd have to work behind that rim joist. It would be a challenge if you had to replace that siding. You could probably do it.
So what's your plan? I mean, you must have thought of that, right?
My plan is to not change my siding on the back of the house. I have vinyl siding, and that has, you know, I don't know what the life expectancy of it is, but it's not something that's typically replaced.
What do you mean it's not typically replaced?
How often do people replace their vinyl siding?
I don't know. How long does it last?
It lasts a very, very long time.
Okay.
And even if it did need replaced, you wouldn't necessarily need to replace the piece behind the rim joist. In other words, you could just work up from there.
Right.
You know, if you had a bad piece of siding, we'll talk about that on another show, maybe even do a video on how to do it, but you can replace just part of your siding if you need it.
That's already all over YouTube, how to replace. I already checked that out.
So if I had a, you know, put my grill up against the house and damaged some of that siding and needed to replace it.
There you go. That's the video that's out there. Evidently, it's pretty common for people to melt part of their siding with their grill.
Right. So. Well, actually, when I was doing the design of the deck, I actually figured where my grill would go, where certain furniture pieces would go, and lights and, you know, all of that, took that into consideration. And my grill is not against the house.
That's a good idea. And you said that the Ipe is, you know, doesn't really burn easily, so you should be good to go.
It doesn't. Same fire rating as concrete, whatever that means.
You just build a fire pit right on your deck.
I could. I'm not gonna, but.
All right. Well, so there you have it. Ipe freestanding deck. And we got so involved in talking about your deck, we're going to run out of time. We're not going to have time to talk about plywood, which seems kind of boring, but is actually a little bit more interesting when you consider trying to buy quality plywood.
Right. So, well, next show, we'll talk about plywood.
We'll talk about plywood and more on the next issue, the next episode of the Handy Guys Podcast. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks. See ya.
The Handy Guys will be back next week. Same handy time, same handy website.